American-led airstrikes continued this weekend, targeting the militant group ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
The organization's rapid rise threw Iraq into disarray and changed the shape of the civil war in Syria as well. While the organization seemed to come out of nowhere and caught the U.S. by surprise, our next guest breaks down the story of ISIS in a new Frontline documentary.
Martin Smith is with us now. He's a producer and filmmaker for Frontline. His new documentary is The Rise of ISIS. It airs tonight at 9 on public television stations here in Wisconsin. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Well, you start the story with the withdrawal of the last U.S. ground troops from Iraq in late 2011. Here's a listen to President Obama pulled from your documentary.
What we have now achieved is an Iraq that is self-governing, that is inclusive, and that has enormous potential.
Well, at that time, the seed that grew into ISIS was the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq. What did that group look like at that point when the U.S. Completed its withdrawal?
At that point, they were pretty much on their last legs. They had been turned on by not only a surge in U.S. troops in 2007, but tribesmen of the so-called Sunni Awakening had come over to fight against them. And they really were just a few embittered tribesmen, some jihadis, some al-Qaeda remnants, and some Baathists who were looking to regain power. But they were basically a pretty small force, not really much of a threat.
Well, a theme throughout this Frontline documentary is how the Shiite Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, treated Sunnis in Iraq and how that contributed to the problem. After the withdrawal of U.S. troops, what did the Prime Minister do with the Sunni community?
Broadly speaking, he did a couple of things. One is he cracked down on people he suspected of being a threat to him. That meant not only ordinary Sunni men who were suspected of subversion for some reason or another, but also members of his own cabinet. His vice president, as well as his finance minister, were purged. The vice president was tried in absentia and given a death sentence. And this greatly angered a broad swath of Sunnis, who began peaceful demonstrations that went on for a long time. The other thing that he did that's really significant is that he, fearing that there might be a coup d'etat, he took people in the military and fired them if he suspected they weren't loyal enough to him. And he replaced them with people who would be loyal. But in doing so, the army lost a lot of its professionalism. It became an army of cronies more than a professional army, even after the Americans had spent so much treasure to train and equip that army. It was really a sort of rotten at the core by the time ISIS was moving on Fallujah and Mosul this year.
In addition to the purges in the government and in the army, even daily life for Sunnis, especially young men, was difficult. You have a British former intelligence officer saying it was commonplace to see Sunnis with bullets in their heads due to Shia militia.
That's true. And by 2013, you see a real spike in violence from these militia that are taking out revenge on Sunnis that they suspected of being part of an insurgency. But in many cases, people were held in prisons without charges for months on end, and people were, in some cases, documented by the United Nations, executed without trials.
Did this lead Sunnis who might not have been sympathetic to an al-Qaeda holdover group being more willing to accept them as a viable option to the Iraqi government?
Well, it radically polarized the country, of course. But what really took it down that path was when there was a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, been going on for months in the town of Hawija in north of Baghdad. And we don't know exactly what happened. There may have been a provocateur from the among the demonstrators, but at whatever happened exactly, the forces of Maliki's government, the police and the army, unleashed a fusillade of bullets on the peaceful demonstrators, and you had the massacre of scores of Sunnis. And that led a lot of Sunnis to conclude that they really needed more muscle. And it was around that same time that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became the Islamic State of Iraq, had now changed its name to the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria, or Al-Sham, or Levant, depending. And that was when they started to see more people coming into their ranks. And it's not the, and of course they're now starting to get some foreign recruits. So they're growing in different ways, and different people come to join ISIS today with very different motivations. But the core of it, and that's what we explain in the documentary, was widespread Sunni anger, frustration, disenfranchisement it gets to the point where Sunnis just don't think they have any option but to let ISIS be their protector.
We've stayed on the Iraqi side of the border, but you point also in the documentary to the entry of this group that became ISIS into Syria, the idea of the Syrian civil war as a gift to these militants. How so? How did they take off so quickly?
It was essentially the incubator. In all insurgencies, it's very important that they have some kind of sanctuary, a place they can go, whether, you know, it's the Taliban has used Pakistan that way. And through history, the importance of sanctuary is key. It's also true that when they go into, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of the group, sends a few men over into Syria, he has surrounded himself with some rather experienced military officers who are very smart and able to, not only are they raising money from around the Gulf from deep-pocketed Sunnis for their cause, they're able to become a self-sustaining operation by running extortion rackets, taxing the local population, and even seizing oil fields and selling oil on the black market. And quickly, within 12 months, the group that was Al-Qaeda in Iraq and is going to become ISIS has become a self-sustaining operation with increasing numbers of fighters in its ranks.
We're talking to Martin Smith about his new Frontline documentary, The Rise of ISIS, looking at the history, the goals of the Islamic State movement.
And you can join our conversation. Do you have a question about how the group became so powerful in Syria and Iraq? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Martin Smith. His new Frontline documentary is called The Rise of ISIS.
Now, Martin, we had just talked about the progress of what became ISIS early on in Iraq, their cross-border move into Syria. In those earlier stages, was the United States sitting up and taking notice, doing anything in response?
Well, the United States was paying attention. There were certainly discussions about what was happening in Iraq and in Syria. And there were recommendations, as any, if you watch the documentary, you will see that both Ambassador Ford to Syria and Ambassador Jeffrey to Iraq, as well as senior members of the cabinet, were advising the administration that something should be done to arm moderate rebels in Syria, in order to prevent the ISIS rebels from becoming dominant, and also to hold Maliki's feet to the fire and do more on the one hand to leverage what we could to get reforms of his government. At the same time, as things got worse, to give him some more weapons so he could repel ISIS. But those for reasons that I think are defensible, the administration felt, I think, twofold. They felt that what was happening in those countries was not posing an imminent threat to the United States. And this is a president who was elected on the basis of the country's consensus being that it's time to get out of the area. And the other was that they simply didn't trust Maliki. If he would make a promise of one kind or another, their experience, what they expressed to me, was that he didn't follow through. So they didn't have a partner that they could trust. So for those two reasons, you know, they did increase some weapons transfers, but the Iraqis that I spoke to felt that it wasn't enough. And I think the Obama administration really, until recently, didn't feel that they were dealing with a threat that warranted more attention.
So picking up the thread of where ISIS went next, they had gotten this support, as you said, in Iraq because of the Maliki government driving Sunnis into ever more angry opposition to his practices. In Syria, they'd picked up recruits, some weapons, some funding. What tactics did they turn to now in Iraq?
Well, they have launched a program called Breaking the Walls, which was focused on attacking 8 major prisons. And they start this in mid-2012, and it culminates in 2013 with a major breakout of prisoners from Abu Ghraib, the infamous prison. And more than 500 inmates are released, and that swells their ranks. A lot of these guys were already insurgents. And so that is a major focus. They had another program called Soldiers Harvest. That was their term for it, where they would seek out Iraqi soldiers and kill them and destroy their homes as a part of an intimidation program. And then when we get a little later on, in January of this year, they're able to actually seize Fallujah, which is not so many miles outside of Baghdad. And you know, the story from there is known somewhat. I mean, they take Mosul in June of this year.
I want to get back to Mosul in a moment, but let's go to the phones with Mikhail in Eau Claire. Mikhail, hi.
Yes, hello. I just had a question about how they have become so well-armed and who's supplying them their weapons, and how have they acquired so many to where they're such a formidable force?
Mikhail, thanks. Martin?
Sure, it's a good question, and I'll divide it into two parts. The first part is that before they take Mosul, they are able to get weapons because they are getting support and money through their own operations, as I've mentioned, their extortion rackets or their oil sales. And they can buy weapons on the black market, or they learn about weapon shipments that are going to the more moderate rebels, and they then hit those rebels and steal their weapons. That's one way. After Mosul, it's a different ballgame, because when they roll into Mosul and the Iraqi army abandons their post and flees the city, they're able to collect tons upon tons of U.S.-made sophisticated weaponry, tanks, artillery, armored Humvees, and more. And so by the time we get to June of this year, they're a formidable fighting force. Now, they may not be as organized as some, but they're one of the better-armed armies in the region. And when they went against Kurdistan, they were able to overrun the Peshmerga. That's the Kurdish fighting force, because the ISIS fighters had superior American weapons.
And one thing I learned in this documentary I hadn't realized, the takeover of Mosul was a surprise to everyone, including ISIS themselves.
Yeah, now they thought they were just going to do another prison breakout. This was information that came via Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker, who had spoken to an intelligence agent in Kurdistan, who said that the idea that Mosul had was to roll in the city, have a couple of suicide bombs outside the prison, and free more prisoners. But when they got in, the army just collapsed. And so they said, hey, we're just going to keep going. And they were able to take the whole city within a matter of a few days. Only 800 fighters came in initially, and they got the city, just fell in their hands. They were really pushing on an open door.
You mentioned one difference from al-Qaeda to ISIS, this idea of taking territory, holding it, getting this revenue stream. Also, even more bloodlust in some ways than al-Qaeda. That's part of what led al-Qaeda internationally to break with ISIS. Why this focus on executions and killing to a degree we hadn't seen previously?
You know, I can only speculate there, but I think that it's been effective for them in terms of terrorizing people that might go up against them, whether that be the Iraqi security forces, the Peshmerga, or other rebel groups in Syria, or the Syrian army itself. I think I think they use that as a tactic to scare the hell out of people with their viciousness. It is a different animal than Al-Qaeda in that they are not a hit-and-run operation. They are all about seizing territory and holding it and declaring a state. They've, of course, now called themselves the Islamic State, and they claim that they are going to be erasing more borders than simply the Syrian and Iraqi border. They're very ambitious in their rhetoric. It's hard to know how far they can go. The bombs have certainly, are a burden upon them. But right now they seem to be able to hold on to quite a bit of territory.
Martin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Martin Smith. He's the producer of the new Frontline documentary. It's called The Rise of ISIS. You can see that on your local public television station. It's going to air tonight at 9.